Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, monsters, heroes, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're done. We have finished the Greek Mythos chapter of Deities and Demigods. And as is traditional when we end a section, we're going to do an overview, a recap. We're going to talk about what we've seen, what we've learned, and how we might use Greek mythology in a fantasy campaign. I said in the last episode that I thought that there were a lot of challenges in using Greek mythology, maybe more than any of the other mythological sections that we've covered so far, or at least, if not more, then certainly different challenges. One of the problems of Greek mythology is that it's permeated popular culture to such an extent. Now, there are other mythologies that have done so. So I talked in a recent special episode of Monster Man about the extent to which things like the Journey to the West and other Chinese legendary stories have entered kind of pan-Asian popular culture and made their characters so recognizable. Or arguably, I mean, I think most people are now pretty familiar with Norse mythology, even if only through the mighty Thor, right, through Marvel movies. But it's come up in a lot of other contexts as well. I think most people could tell you who, you know, Thor and Odin are, even if they maybe couldn't tell you who, like, Ul and Hermod are. But here's the thing. Greek mythology entered Western pop culture in this kind of foundational way, right? It entered it, you know, it was discussed in Western literature in the Middle Ages, in the Renaissance, in the early modern period, and the result is that it entered Western popular culture, but not really in like a fun way. It has the dusty scent of the establishment all over it, you know, upper class toffs quoting Homer to show off, you know, their level of culture, multinational brands selling Nike shoes and Hermes, whatever it is that Hermes sells is. Now, there have been films and books and things that made effective use of Greek mythology in pop culture, but I would argue that proportionally far fewer than you would expect, given how immediately recognizable the myths of the ancient Greeks are to modern audiences. You know, everybody knows who Hercules was, or Heracles, but there isn't a definitive pop cultural portrayal. Indeed, even the successful Hercules TV show is better known for its better known spin-off. Greek myth is familiar, but it's become familiar in a way that is rather uninspiring, a way that has a certain redolence of the schoolroom. And I think that that's a shame, because there is a lot of good material in these myths that can be a lot of fun in a game. I do think that you have to tinker with it a little bit, at least if you're trying to achieve certain effects, right? Obviously, I'm starting from the presumption that you're trying to run a particular type of game. I think there is a role for this stodgy establishment version of Greek mythology, actually. I'll talk about that later on in this episode. But unfortunately, for most of us, I think Greek myth comes with this kind of inherited sense of corniness that has to kind of be scrubbed off. So how do we do this? I think there are two main ways to use the material from Greek mythology in a role-playing game. The first is to use Greek myth as an inspiration for your fantasy pantheon, because I think that a lot of the exciting and interesting concepts that are present in Greek mythology are more recognizable to players, paradoxically, when the familiar faces of Zeus and Athena and Poseidon and so forth are removed from them. You can actually see this in Glorantha. I know I always come back to Glorantha, but you can see this in Glorantha, where a lot of stories about Orlanth, when you think about wild, impetuous, adventurous, thundering Orlanth, you think, oh yeah, he's like Thor, or he's like Indra. And those are both true, but he's also like Zeus. Indeed, Orlanth probably bears as much resemblance to Zeus as he does to Thor. And we are not used to thinking of him that way, particularly if you, like I did, kind of got into Glorantha in the very late 90s, early 2000s, when Celtic-y, Viking-y, Orlanthi were the norm, rather than the more kind of Mediterranean-y look that they have about them now. I think you can take a lot of fun inspiration from Greek myths, from the story of the Titanomachy, from the relationships between deities and mortals. And I think a couple of the things that you're looking for are, first, the idea of divinity as a human mask on a primal cosmic force. We can really see this in characters like Oceanus, where on the one hand he's this personified guy who has brothers and sisters and a wife and whatever, seemingly endless supply of lovely daughters, but also he's the roaring ocean that surrounds the whole world. You can even see this in Zeus, who on the one hand is squabbling with his wife and having affairs and whatever, but then, and you know, Hesiod, I wouldn't say that the Theogony, at least in the translation that I read it in, is a fun read. But if you're used to thinking of Zeus as kind of Clash of the Titans Zeus, you know, or even Iliad Zeus, this complex character who's always kind of getting pulled in different directions by the different quarreling Olympian gods, it's interesting to see these sudden moments of majesty that we get out of Zeus in the Theogony. But the idea that these gods have these human qualities and they have these cosmic qualities, and both of those exist at the same time, I think is a very characteristic feature of Greek mythology, and one that can really make gods more effective in any fantasy game. I've always been a big fan of contradiction and multiplicity as aspects of divinity, and I think Greek mythology has good examples of that in a way that the representation of it can sometimes elide by reducing the gods to these more simple versions of their characters. Secondly, arguably, the kind of second generation of Olympian deities are a little more human than their predecessors. So if you think of Apollo and Athena and Artemis and you compare them to Zeus and Hera and Hades and Poseidon, I think you get the sense of these kind of like somewhat more relatable characters, Hermes as well. Not that there isn't a cosmic power behind them, but the idea of multiple generations of deities with different deities having different levels of sort of humanity, I think is an interesting one. Even if, you know, if you ask me to systematically apply that idea to Greek myth, I don't know that I could do it. But I definitely think there's a sense that these younger divinities are maybe a little bit more, for want of a better term, relatable. One of the things that I like about Greek mythology is the way in which gods and monsters interact directly. So we can see this in the story of the Minotaur, where the relationship of the Cretans to Poseidon is at the heart of the whole story. Or Medusa, right, who is assaulted by Poseidon, punished by Athena. Or, I don't even remember who transformed Lamia into a monster, right? But there are lots and lots of these kinds of stories where some creature is created by a god as a punishment to mankind or just as kind of a side effect of whatever the god was doing. That's quite interesting, and I like the idea of these things that exist in the adventuring landscape that are direct evidence of the interaction of the gods with the mortal world. Finally, one thing that we can take from ancient Greek religion that I think is really relevant is the idea of regional and local variation. So, ancient Greek religion, as opposed to ancient Greek mythology, well, I mean, both of them, I suppose, were highly varied. So, different parts of the Greek-speaking world had very different beliefs about the gods or different rites with which they celebrated them, and this was not thought to be unusual. This was understood that, you know, there was no official sacred text of this religion, there was no centralized religious authority. Instead, there was a shared collection of tales and images and social and ritual practices that produced unique combinations in different places. And that is a model that is very much in contrast to what we think about as a religion if we come from a particular cultural background. But that cultural background's view is actually maybe a little unusual. That model of religion, that it is a shared set of mythological elements, is actually a pretty widespread one. What's really good about this in a game is that it motivates clerics to be curious, and it stops clerics from being the fun police, at least in terms of religious belief. So as you are arriving at a new town, your priest of Artemis can say, Here we are approaching Ephesus. I've always wanted to learn about the sacred rites of Artemis at Ephesus. I hear they're so different from the ones that we have in Athens. And that motivates the priest to get in touch with the local members of the cult or just local people who know those traditions and those rites. And it takes away from the player of the cleric the burden of being an expert on the in-game lore, and instead motivates that player to be curious about that in-game knowledge, that their job is not to be the one who just tells you, oh, well, in the beginning the gods, blah, 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 but instead is motivated to find these things out in play. It moves the focus of the cleric's knowledge from doing homework to talking to NPCs or whatever. And that's very valuable in my view. Our goal is to replicate the feel of Greek mythology, and if we want to replicate the feel of Greek mythology in a fantasy game, then that means to some degree replicating the feel of ancient Greek society. And that means a society that has some shared cultural assumptions, shared language, and so forth, but which nonetheless recognizes the idea that places are going to differ, customs are going to differ, and that's fine and great. For the most part, that's an oversimplification. The second alternative in presenting Greek mythology in a role-playing game is to use the Greek mythology that we're familiar with, but present it in an unfamiliar or unexpected way. This is maybe more if you want to run the kind of game that I like, because I'm kind of imposing my own aesthetic preferences here. It so happens that I like mythology which has a kind of mysterious energy to it. At present, a lot of us are playing online, and when I play online, I use more visual representation, or at least different kinds of visual representation, than I do at a tabletop, because there are certain modes of communication in terms of body language, in terms of crosstalk, that are not available to me. And of course, I can't use miniatures, which are a big thing for me, although I know that other people don't share my love for them. What that means is that I'm using a lot of illustrations, a lot of photographs, things like that, to quickly convey visual information. If you're going to do this for a Greek mythology campaign, I would suggest avoiding the things that have that kind of like classical look, that more realistic or idealized depiction of the human form. That's what we think of when we think of Greek mythology. Lots of tall, noble figures with wreaths upon their brows and that kind of thing. And I think if you look at earlier things, or if you look at pottery decoration, you'll see a more stylized way of representing the human figure and of representing gods and monsters that I think actually helps to restore that mysterious feel. Look for stuff that's a little stiffer, a little more grotesque, that's less often imitated by modern artists. Another way to retain a sense of mystery and unfamiliarity in something as familiar as Greek mythology is to focus on areas of the pantheon that are less commonly adapted. We've actually seen this with the focus on certain deities. So, for example, Dionysus or Hecate. Those are deities that actually played a pretty important role in Greek religion, Greek mythology, but who are not, like, they don't play starring roles in, well, Hecate doesn't anyway, in myths that we frequently see adapted. You know, get into some of the weird underworld stuff. One thing to do is, if we feel like Zeus and Poseidon, you know, have the smell of the establishment on them, make them the establishment in your game. Make the clerics of Zeus corrupt and close to the levers of power. Make the clerics of Poseidon hidebound traditionalists. You know, make the clerics of, you know, Hera backstabbing intriguers, and so on and so forth. But have your player characters among the kind of scruffier, outcastier, wandering types, you know, with clerics of Hermes and Dionysus and Hecate. Make them look up to the adventures of Heracles, who shook the pillars of Olympian self-assuredness in the same way that your player characters one day hope to. And by kind of refocusing on a side of ancient Greek life that was as important and as real, but is less commonly represented, you know, with fewer towering columns and fewer tall, nodding, plumed bronze helmets, I think you can actually do something really interesting there. You know, there's room for plenty of fun ancient Greek gaming that shows a slightly different side of that ancient Greek culture. Finally, the question of heroes. This is actually one where I don't feel like I have a strong suggestion. I've discussed some of the ways that you can deal with hero characters. The Greek mythology section seems particularly laden with them. You notice that we didn't see very much of it in the Old Norse section. I'm astonished that they didn't try to shoehorn in Beowulf, who is, of course, not a character from Old Norse literature, but, you know, he is in the fiction. You know, although the poem is English, it's set in Scandinavia, so hey, you know. They put in the Fossagrim, and that's a piece of modern Scandinavian folklore. I don't really know what to do about these guys. I do think, you know what, actually, I say that. I'm currently with my wife listening to another D&D podcast, which is ironically called Not Another D&D Podcast. And the first sort of arc of that is called The Campaign After the Campaign, and is about, like, the consequences of a world saved by these legendary heroes. So there's already been, basically, a D&D campaign in which these three people found a bunch of magic artifacts and saved the world, but the kind of premise of it is that that did not end things. And so now these three other characters, who are all just kind of living in the world that these heroes made, wind up dealing with the consequences of that world saving and kind of getting into scrapes and escaping and so forth. It's not the kind of family-friendly listening to Monster Man is, so that's not a recommendation. I'm just saying that there is maybe something to be said for the idea of, like, what happens after the heroic deeds are done. But the problem is that most ancient Greek heroes don't really, they're not saving the world in the main, they're just accomplishing extraordinary feats. I'm super concerned about what I'm gonna do about the Arthurian section, which is just a big long list of knights. And the only advice I can give you about running an Arthurian campaign is, you know, I wouldn't start from here. Like, if you wanted to run an Arthurian game, Pendragon exists. Play Pendragon. But anyway, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. I don't have to worry about the Arthurian section yet, because the poll numbers are in, and you have all selected Babylon. We're going to talk about Babylonian mythology, which is essentially going to serve as a kind of sequel to our very first season, was it, on Sumerian mythology. Indeed, some of the texts that I read cover mythology that was, like, applicable in Sumer, but actually they are Babylonian. So I'm pretty sure I quoted the Enuma Elish, which is a Babylonian text. So I'm quite looking forward to that. It does mean we're going to revisit the Epic of Gilgamesh, and I do have a nice new translation of it that I'm looking forward to getting into in detail. There is a part of me that has always wanted to run an ancient Greek game. I say that. I mean, indeed, I ran a D&D 3rd edition, and then we transitioned to a different system game set in a kind of Hellenistic rather than ancient setting for a good while. And it was, you know, I think of it as only moderately successful, but I do feel that the social structures of that historical period actually in many ways provide a better backdrop for fantastic adventuring than medieval ones. And the religious openness of the Greek and Roman worlds provide more opportunities for interesting religious roleplay than the more, not completely, but more religiously uniform culture of the pseudo-medieval setting. And indeed, even though D&D typically has pseudo-medieval settings, I think it's telling that they tend to have a more ancient approach toward religious pluralism. I think there's a lot of fun to be had with these myths. I think there's a lot of fun to be had with ancient Greek society, but we have to struggle with the level of familiarity that the players have. So we either take those things and we show them in a new light that renders them unfamiliar, or we look for all the very real things that there are about those myths and about those cultures which render them unfamiliar to modern audiences. And I think if you can do that, then you can make effective use of all the fun material that there is to be had. All right, that is it for the Greek mythos section. In our next episode, we're going to begin our journey through the Babylonian mythos section of Deities and Demigods. It's pretty short. And as always, we're going to start with an overview of the mythology and a look at the supreme deity, Anu, Lord of the Heavens, a very remote supreme deity who contains all the cosmos, but who doesn't actually do a whole lot, leaving intervention in mortal affairs to two children, aspects, something like that, Enlil and Ea. But we'll talk about all that next time on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.